Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org. Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Marjorie Garber has been writing about Shakespeare for years, earning a reputation as one of the world's premier Shakespeare scholars. And she's come to the conclusion that many of the things we think of as our own, the things that define our culture and who we are, were determined by a man who lived 400 years ago. In her new book, she argues that Shakespeare makes modern culture, and that modern culture makes Shakespeare. She gave Anne Strainchamp some examples.
Shakespeare has become for us the equivalent of a kind of modern public intellectual. We use taglines from Shakespearean phrases in headlines, in advertisements, as commentaries on the political scene, so that Shakespeare seems as a voice, almost disembodied from the plays, to be playing a part in the construction of modern culture.
But, you know, you think about other great playwrights in the English language, George Bernard Shaw or Shakespeare's contemporary Christopher Marlowe. They aren't cultural bywords in the way that Shakespeare is.
Well, that's true. But again, Marlowe wrote fewer plays. He died young and there was no immediate Marlowe industry. There really was a Shakespeare industry, starting with the First Folio in 1623, produced by members of his company, the Shakespeare Jubilee in the 18th century, where the great Shakespearean actor David Garrick, who was also a theater manager, produced a kind of a theme park day or several days in which people celebrated the person of Shakespeare. It's interesting, the Shakespeare Jubilee, because there was no production of a Shakespeare play there. So far as we can tell, there were no readings from the plays. There were anthems and theme songs and folk songs written about the plays. There was an ox roast and so forth. It really was a kind of Disneyfication before that concept of the idea of Shakespeare. And this would be one moment of beginning the idea that actually Shaw coined the term for, the idea of bardolatry, of the worship of the bard, of the worship of Shakespeare. So that Shakespeare has become a cultural commodity as well as a powerful playwright and literary voice.
Well, let's talk about some of the plays themselves. Romeo and Juliet, for instance, is one that everybody seems to know whether they've ever actually seen it or not. The most recent film version I'm thinking of was Shakespeare in Love, you know, that kind of play within a play about the writing of Romeo and Juliet. And In that one, there's the young Will Shakespeare sort of becomes Romeo himself, suggesting that besides loving the plays themselves, we've also now turned Shakespeare into a romantic hero.
Well, I think that's true of the script of Shakespeare in Love, which is a Tom Stoppard script and a Norman script and terrific in its own way. But Romeo and Juliet has become for our culture an anthem for youth culture in general.
Romeo, Romeo, a young man of Verona. A comedy by William Shakespeare.
My lady!
Who's that?
Will Shakespeare.
Anon, good nurse, anon. Master Shakespeare.
The same, alas.
Oh, but why alas?
A lowly player.
Alas, indeed. For I thought you the highest poet of my esteem, and a writer of plays that capture my heart.
Oh, I am him too.
Madam? Anon! I will come again.
Oh, I am fortune's fool. I will be punished for this. My lady, my love.
If they find you here, they will kill you.
You can bring them with a word.
Oh, not for the world.
Madam!
Anon!
When I first started studying Shakespeare as a young person in school, the first play that I was taught was Julius Caesar, which was a historical play connected to the study of Latin that was going on in the next door classroom and so forth, and was not at all a romantic play or a play about love and sex and young people. It's very interesting that right now this is the play, Romeo and Juliet, which introduces lots and lots of middle school readers or high school readers to Shakespeare.
Let's talk about some of the other plays and how characters have changed over time. Hamlet, for instance. Is our Hamlet very different from Shakespeare's?
Well, Shakespeare had many different Hamlets because there are many different versions of the play in Shakespeare's time. Only the first quarto of Shakespeare, what used to be called the bad quarto of Shakespeare that's now been rediscovered by actors as a great playing vehicle, doesn't include the soliloquies. And so the play moves much more quickly. And it doesn't have those great pauses for reflection, those great set pieces that think about consciousness and that have led some people to think of Hamlet as an originator of the idea of psychic interiority, of thinking of the man who thinks too much, the famous Olivier notion that this is a man who couldn't make up his mind. In fact, Hamlet makes up his mind quite a lot about a lot of things. But the early versions of the play didn't always stress the centrality of the thinking, dreaming Hamlet as opposed to the Hamlet of action. This is also true, really, of 20th century versions, that the Mel Gibson Hamlet is very different from the Olivier Hamlet, that different stagings of the play have tried to return Hamlet to his role as lover, to his role as political figure, to make him look more like Fortinbras and less like a philosopher detached from his time. Mm-hmm. Again, the play has gone through Hamlet was such a favorite of the 19th century and became a play that was cited by lyric poets like Coleridge, famously saying, "I have a smack of Hamlet myself, if I do say so." And by that, he meant that he was himself a procrastinator who had difficulty finishing projects. And Hamlet became a great favorite also of Goethe and of German writers. And the idea of Hamlet as basically a romantic figure in the notion of romanticism as well as of a dreaming figure, someone involved with creativity, with imagination, and not with the world of action. This became the Hamlet to a certain extent of the 19th century, and we have restored some of the more active elements of Hamlet in especially late 20th century productions.
That's interesting.
The Michael Almereyda Hamlet, the Hamlet that starred Ethan Hawke, actually, as a kind of slacker Hamlet set in a corporate culture, I thought was a terrific production and very much more a production about alienated youth coming back into action.
Rightly, to be great is not to stir without great argument, but greatly to find quarrel in a straw when honor is at the stake. How stand I then, that have a father killed, a mother stained? Excitements of my reason and my blood, and let all sleep. From this time forth, my thoughts be bloody, or be nothing worth.
One of the more interesting things you found is how often Shakespeare appears now in contemporary business culture. Turns out Shakespeare is used to teach business and management principles to future CEOs.
Absolutely, to CEOs in leadership institutes all around the country and all around the world. There have been a big spate of books called Shakespeare on Management or The Bard in the Boardroom or things like that, where Shakespeare's plays are used as case studies for executives and corporate figures to discuss things like decision making or how to fire somebody or how to assume command. And the play that has been a particular favorite, though they talk about Macbeth and Othello and Hamlet, one of the great favorite plays, of course, has been Henry V, which is a play about an executive, in this case a king, a young man who sheds his wild background and becomes a powerful leader and has to make certain kinds of difficult decisions. There's one book that talks about Henry V deciding whether or not to hang an old friend for stealing something from a church. Well, this is a problem I hope that few business executives have to deal with. And these books have actually done quite well and been used as textbooks within business schools, but also, as I say, for summer institutes and for people returning for refresher courses. Instead of a case study from the social world, these are case studies from Shakespeare, another example of how Shakespeare and modern culture have come together.
You reprint a cartoon of Hillary Clinton as Lady Macbeth. Of course, she's probably not the only female politician to have been compared to Lady Macbeth.
quite right. Margaret Thatcher was compared to Lady Macbeth, and Nancy Pelosi was compared to Lady Macbeth, and indeed Condoleezza Rice was compared to Lady Macbeth. For a while there, Lady Macbeth was a kind of cultural macro for the powerful woman thought to be very ambitious. It's interesting, though, to see how dated, in a way, that cartoon of Hillary Clinton is, that now things have moved on, and her being in a newly powerful position has not spawned a new set of rather resentful cartoons about her getting above herself and being like Lady Macbeth.
Come, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, unsex me here and fill me from the crown to the toe top full of direst cruelty. Make thick my blood, stop up the access and passage to remorse, that no compunctious visitings of nature shake my fell purpose, nor keep peace between the effect and it. Come to my woman's breasts and take my milk for gall, you murdering ministers. Wherever in your sightless substances you wait on nature's mischief. Come, thick night, and pall thee in the dunnest smoke of hell, that my keen knife see not the wound it makes, nor heaven peep through the blanket of the dark to cry, hold, hold.
For a while there, this was a way of cutting down to size women who had achieved something in the political realm, to call them Lady Macbeths and to suggest that somehow they were ambitious rather than effective. And I rather hope we've moved beyond that stereotype, but it was very powerful as a way of labeling independent women in the political sphere for quite a long time.
Are there other Shakespeare characters who've had a kind of rise and fall as cultural icons? Were there others in other ages, for instance?
Well, the figure of Falstaff was one of the earliest characters that got picked up as a separate character, with books being written about Falstaff, and where he seemed to, again, overwhelm the other characters in the Henry IV plays. And I think is less a figure for our time than he was for earlier times.
Now, why do you think that is? What was it about Falstaff that appealed so to an earlier age, and why does he not speak to us today?
Well, he himself at one moment in Henry IV allies himself with younger friends in the tavern and says, you know, they hate us youth, associating himself with young people. And I think this kind of attempting to recapture a lost youth or something, which looked very, you know, brave and amusing to a certain culture, now looks a little bit out of place. We're in a serious age now. We're in a age in which people evaluate their own responsibilities in various ways, feel that they need to pay attention to the economy and the war and their families and their social responsibilities and so forth. And so a character like Falstaff, who joyously abandons all of those commitments, has a certain kind of delicious theatrical power for us, but is less, I think, a model for a certain kind of standing apart from the everyday world.
So I'm curious, what do you yourself, as a Shakespeare scholar, somebody who's written many books about Shakespeare's plays, what do you make of Shakespeare's continued presence in our popular culture? I mean, does this seem a sad thing to you because you see Shakespeare being so diluted in our popular culture?
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
Cause for celebration.
No, I think it's terrific. These popular culture appropriations seem to me to be a very good thing. It means that Shakespeare is being mainstreamed. It means that we're thinking through the plays in various ways. The plays are very tough, resilient vehicles. No production, no citation of them can alter their essence except to make them more resonant for us. And again, one of the plays that I talk about in this connection is The Merchant of Venice, which after the Holocaust, after World War II, took on a cultural resonance, a certain set of extra cultural meanings that were different from but very much in consonance with the power of the play beforehand. This is a play that has changed enormously over time, from the early productions in which Shylock was a villain through his becoming a figure of pathetic sensibility, of real pathos around the turn of the 19th, 20th century. The play became a great vehicle for the Yiddish theater as well as for the English and American theaters, and indeed was produced in Nazi Germany as well as in America during the war. But the post-Holocaust view of The Merchant of Venice incorporates all of that history and suggests something both about the enormous resilience and power of the lines and the characters in the play, and also about the way in which culture can continue to add to the power of a great literary vehicle like this. And that really is the argument of my whole book, that Shakespeare in popular culture, that Shakespeare in high culture, we really shouldn't make so many distinctions between those things. I think this is all our modern culture. And wherever we encounter Shakespeare, it enriches both Shakespeare and our own lives.
Let him look to his bond. He was wont to call me usurer. Let him look to his bond. He was wont to lend money for a Christian curse. Let him look to his bond.
Well, I'm sure if he forfeit, thou wilt not take his flesh. What's that good for?
To bait fish withal. If it will feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge. He hath disgraced me and hindered me 500,000, laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated mine enemies. And what's his reason? I am a Jew. Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is? If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge. If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferance be by Christian example? Why, revenge. The villainy you teach me, I will execute, and it shall go hard, but I will better the instruction.
Marjorie Garber is a professor at Harvard University. She's written several books on Shakespeare, including most recently, On Shakespeare and Modern Culture. She talked with Anne Strangechamps.